Hey everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Blind Ambition with Jack Kelly. It's your friend Rick from Blind, and today I'm going to introduce you all to Jack Mardak, who's the co-founder and chief impact officer at Oyster. Before starting Oyster, Jack was the head of marketing or growth at Eventbrite, Prezi, Vonage, and more. And for those of you that don't know, Oyster is a global employment platform that empowers companies to hire, pay, and care for their global teams, and enables people-centric hiring anywhere in the world with reliable, compliant contracts, payroll, and great local benefits and perks. The company was last publicly valued at more than $1 billion after having raised a $150 million Series C in August 2023. Thanks for coming on the show, Jack.
It is a great pleasure. Thank you, Rick.
Go ahead, Rick.
So can you just walk us through your career? I mean, you've just been working as a high-powered executive at some of these
not always
well-known tech companies.
There's definitely an arc there, and you know, I'm sometimes asked to comment on kind of key learnings from that. And one of the things that I would share is I think it's okay not to know what you want to be when you grow up. By that I mean, I didn't have a very conscious career plan or kind of a very, very specific sense of what I wanted to do. And I think a lot of folks feel insecure when they don't have that kind of clarity. And so I wanted to share that that wasn't the case for me. And I think it turned out okay. I did ultimately sort of become a marketer, but it was very accidental. It was very accidental. So to go all the way back, I suppose my career began at around 8 years old when I really felt the weight of my mother's expectation that I would be a doctor, right? And she was very clear on this. And you know what? For the most part, it was great because from the age of eight till about 18 or 19, when I really changed my mind about that, I enjoyed having that identity. Like I was always introduced that, oh, this is Vicky's son, Jack, he's going to be a doctor. And I'm like 11, right? So no pressure, but it was also kind of cool. And so that is looking back at that, a deep reflection on sort of the value from an identity standpoint that we get or can get from the work that we do. Ultimately, I decided that I didn't want to be a doctor. And I had a first career in finance, in banking. I had had a STEM education, pre-med at NYU, didn't become a doctor, as I said, and I gravitated towards finance and banking as a way to sort of stepstone on some stuff that I'd already developed, like quantitative skills, modeling, thinking about systems, etc. And it also gave me a great entree into the world of business and commerce and industry. And so hugely important building block for me from a learning and skills collection standpoint. Ultimately, I realized I didn't love it. There were parts of me that weren't satisfied from that kind of work. And I should say that I didn't have a career plan, but I had a kind of fundamental programming inside me, and I compare that to the programming of the early robots from decades ago who would face complicated terrains but were equipped with surprisingly simple, like left, right, back, back two steps, left, pivot, and with these simple rules they could navigate like a very complicated terrain. So for me, those simple rules were, I wanted to love my work. One of the great examples that I had from my mom, I was raised by a single mom. She worked, she was a journalist and a columnist for Spanish language newspaper named El Diario in New York. And she loved her work, right? And so I got to see an example very close of what it looks like when someone actually digs and really loves your work. So I credit that example to wanting to love what I did. And the other programming was I wanted to work with the smartest people I could find. But I figured whatever else, whether it worked out or it didn't work out, it seemed to increase the likelihood that I would at least learn at an accelerated rate, right? So that simple programming was all that I observed in my trajectory from, I don't love finance so much to, hey, I'm gonna move to the Bay Area because there some cool people are starting companies that could use maybe some of the skills that sort of I've been building. And so I made my way into growth marketing that way as a quantitative person, as a person who was very excited by problems of behavior, designing user experiences intended to make people do things, buy things, et cetera. I found those problems fascinating. I loved them, right? And so that is what got me to that work. And, oh, and by the way, you're in marketing now. Cool. You know, great. Now I know what to call myself. But it was a complete accident, right? And so I wanted to, and then that trajectory, I guess the other programming that I might have picked up along the way is that, let's say, at a certain point you've gotten credit enough times for doing a certain kind of work that you become more valuable and you gain more power in terms of being able to go to work for kinds of companies. And so when that started to happen for me, the other thing that became very important was purpose, right? And that is that I wanted to enjoy my work, but I also wanted it to be significant. And so that is a great convergence to the genesis of Oyster with my co-founder, Tony Jamis, where we both came at that with a vision for evolving how we work. This is pre-pandemic. We were both very excited by a future where technology and would continue to make work, make us all more productive as individual people, as organizations, but also become more human-centric, right? So there's a bunch of philosophies, let's say, to be drawn from that bundle of things into the future of work, et cetera. The other piece was we were excited to reject the assumption that an organization can either be about profit and revenue or it can be about positive impact. That's the historical narrative, that these things are like oil and water, that they don't come together. So we were excited to reject that. And that is the lens through which we saw the incredible Oyster opportunity, which gives us a way to bring business model into alignment with impact. I'd love to expound on that, but let me stop there in answer to the tell us about your career question.
Well, one thing I just want to, it's so interesting. You're the third person I've spoken to in the last week whose parents wanted them to be a doctor and they went into something else, which is really bizarre.
It's a common thing. It's one of the top things.
Is it? Because like one was like, now he's the CEO of KPMG. The other is like a vice chair at PwC. Both were supposed to be doctors. Like your parents put upon them, you're going to be the, like, just your story. You're going to be the doctor. And both of them like, I don't really want to do this. But they had to do something.
Maybe it's an immigrant thing. Yeah. Because let's say immigrants have a narrower sense of what the good jobs are. Right. And I think certainly that was the case for my mother, where, you know, she didn't know about stockbroker or software developer, right? You know, and so that
she probably knew doctor, lawyer, like, you know, just the basic.
Engineer, right? Let's say that would have been the list. But it is interesting. And I certainly reflect a lot on how that influenced my early thinking about identity vis-a-vis, you know, what you do for a living.
What really blows me away, Jack, speaking to the two Aarons in your organization and, you know, writing about your company, it seemed to happen so quickly. In a few years, you know, you went from, I guess, just the beginning, start, you know, nothing to, you know, billion plus valuation. How did, you know, I don't want to ask like, what's the secret sauce, but how did it go so quickly?
Well,
and in a weird time period too.
Much, like much. Time. Well, the weirdness of the time period is not an in spite of, it's partly the because, it's significantly the because. And so the changes of the world, the nature of the disruption, the acceleration of remote work, the acceleration of asking questions about, you know, the future of work, all of that was dramatically accelerated by the post-pandemic, the disruption to the world of work, et cetera. And so for us, it was very much like, you know, two founders dragging their little sailboat of a startup into the water for the first time when, oh my goodness, it looks like the storm of the millennium is brewing on the horizon. And so if you're a sailor with, you know, wind can be amazing, but it can also be incredibly destructive. So where I give us credit is, you know, if you're not careful, you can be dashed apart, right? And that certainly could have happened because so there was such a magnitude of demand and of interest in these services. If we hadn't been ready as an organization, you know, relative to the commitments that we made, you know, I think we could have been overwhelmed as an organization. So where I think we got it right is in finding the right way to execute against these unprecedented circumstances where you had everything from companies where everybody had went from being together in a London office to being distributed in eight European countries. And all of a sudden those companies need a way to handle compliant payroll and contracts for that. And that's just one of the use cases. There are many that involve global employment that have been accelerated over the last couple of years. So, you know, like I said, it's very much the because, not the in spite of for us. The dramatic acceleration of remote work, focus on new needs in organizations to handle the challenges of compliant global employment. All of a sudden, you know, that created radically new demand for these services relative to the pre-pandemic.
And Jack, maybe we should have set this up a little for the audience. So I'll just say from my limited understanding is that the company Oyster HR that you built is really to make it to enable and empower companies to have workers work across the globe wherever they want. So people who maybe are in certain locations and they feel trapped that they, you know, can't go to Silicon Valley or New York City, right, or what have you. So it opens up the door to now they could seek out opportunities wherever. And I guess what you're alluding to by the pandemic and remote work, that became just you're right time, right place. Does that make sense?
Essentially, yeah. I mean, to a miraculous degree that you know, we no one can take credit for who benefited from those events. I Googled in the early pandemic. It was like April of 2020. Silver linings. I wanted a quote for silver linings, and I found this quote from a poet named Thule Kupferberg, and he wrote in a line of one of his poems that when patterns are broken, new worlds emerge. And so I think macro, I draw a lot of encouragement from the fact that it looks like this dramatic disruption across so many of our different systems, the world of work being one of the most affected, has given us an opportunity to do a lot of things better than we did in the past. And that relates to how we work, as an example. There's a lot to talk about there. The other example being, as I said, how we create and operate companies with positive impact in mind. But I want to say that as regards what we see as our opportunity, there's a shift right now amongst companies that have realized that the opportunity to evolve how they work is real. They believe in the productivity gains of distributed work, of remote work, of things like asynchronous communication. And they're also, they've also become, you might say, HR has been waiting for this opportunity for a very long time, which is the realization finally that, you know, we've been saying that that people are a company's greatest assets, but I think it took the pandemic to make us understand the depth of that. And it also forced an understanding that, hey, guess what? You know, who's in charge of this? It's of course it's HR. They are the custodians, not only of the employee experience, but also of how an organization, you know, takes care of its people. And so as we have all kinds of companies of all different sizes who are looking at the world's talent, let's say, with you know, maybe that's not so hard. Maybe we're really excited about the diversity potential of being able to hire in say dozens of countries. And we're also interested in making ourselves attractive as an employer by offering a certain quality of experience. Because of course, the ability to like pay people you never meet who live in other countries, you know, that's not the innovation, right? That is not the innovation. The innovation is for employers that are interested in offering a standard of employment as a way to make themselves attractive in now a global talent market, where it's no longer enough just to put up a website and say, hey, I have some software engineer jobs, you know, here they come. You know, we no longer live in that world, right? And so employers have to make themselves attractive to the talent of the world. So our I think most profound promise to customers is that we are the platform that allows them to tap the global talent pool, make themselves attractive as an employer with things like the experience of the employee, with things like knowledge of what equitable compensation looks like in a certain country for a certain position of a certain seniority, the ability to confer equity where possible in compliance. So that is our purpose. That is what we do as the service that we offer. Our mission is that some of those people that these companies hire should be in, let's call it the developing world, where historically there has simply been no access to these life-changing knowledge work jobs. And so that's how we bring together business model and impact in what I think is a super unique and super elegant way.
You make this point about impact and being people-centric. And for a job function or a discipline like HR that is all about people, sometimes it can get caught up, or perhaps it's a stereotype, that it's all focused on process, procedures, forms, systems, which seems to be inherently at odds with this kind of like people-centric impact or mission that you have. How are you an Oyster kind of tackling that issue? How are you kind of opening up that people-centric philosophy to more companies and kind of more professions around the world?
Fantastic question. The answer is some companies are waking up to this by themselves, right? But let's say there's a lot of inertia in the HR function across, let's say, greater industry business that will take some time to transform. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that we're in the midst of a renaissance of HR. We can remember not so long ago when IT, the function, was derided and made fun of and characterized by the guy with the pocket protector, mm-hmm. with the 8 pens and the tape. He would fumble lamely under your desk for a few minutes and produce no effect, you know. So given the advent of the cloud and data, suddenly that function is, you know, dramatically enlarged in the value, the perceived value, and the actual value that they're bringing to the organization. They have a seat at the table, as it were. And from a, you know, what we think IT is standpoint, our minds are completely different. Similarly, HR, as you say, is leaving behind this history of, let's say, being the antithesis of human centricity, right? I mean, being the party's attendant at some of the most awkward, uncomfortable moments that like employees face, let's say, you know, the farthest thing. And I think that owes a lot, and you know, there's a lot of HR philosophy to consume, and you know, there are folks that have been describing this problem, this tension, for a long time. But let's say generally that HR has been what it is, not through the fault of HR practitioners, but through the force and the constraints that is imposed by, let's say, the greater corporate context, which actually, you know, is not about elevating human beings, but, you know, kind of the opposite, commoditizing them. Not, you know, and I speak very sweepingly. I think this we're much improved from, you know, decades ago, but generally speaking, we're on a journey where the corporate interests are being brought into a different balance with the interests of the employees. And you can look back at the labor unions of the middle of the prior century as necessary evolution. So we're still on that journey, and HR has been, let's say, under the constraints. And so I think what's exciting now is that some companies, hopefully a lot, and hopefully more and more, are realizing that the way to win is actually human centricity, and to elevate these things that in the post-pandemic world, in a post-values shift world, where both consumers and employees are bringing new judgment to bear on the companies that they buy from and go work for, that this is a part of what is necessary going forward. And so, to answer your question finally, you know, we believe in that trend. And so we're very passionately talking to the companies that are already on this bandwagon. And let's say more gently, from a, you know, have you thought about it this way standpoint, we're working with other companies who may need further nudging along on their journey. But the great news is that I think there are more and more HR leaders at more and more companies whose light bulb is lit and who are trying to make this happen, who are trying to make human centricity much as important as it needs to be, you know, for the rest of this decade.
I mean, when you talk about human centricity, does it go over the heads of some people just because it seems like,
sure,
too,
what is
like,
it?
Pie in
yeah,
the sky?
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
How do you make that case? Like, can you like convince the cynics that are out there that, you know, some folks that are listening to this podcast, they might not have had the best experiences.
HR. I'm a cynic. So yeah, put me in there, because I see this every day how employees are feeling miserable and job seekers feeling miserable. So yeah.
Let me give you a clear example. When we were first getting started, it was like right at the beginning of the pandemic. And even though the world is where it was, we were hiring people for the very first time, you know, trying to secure additional investments and, you know, generally take those early steps as an organization that you know, at the very earliest beginnings, you know, hiring its first people. And so because we didn't have an office, and I should say Oyster was committed to not having an office before the pandemic made it popular. We were ready. We were on that train. We were fans of like GitLab and Automattic and Buffer and all the other companies that before the pandemic had been saying, this is amazing. So we were on that train anyway. And then, you know, the world changed and everybody was on that train. But we felt very insecure about our onboarding. Like, you know how when you start you work for a company at an office, maybe, you know, there's like they've decorated your booth area. You have lunch with the team, and you know, who knows, there's a cake, et cetera. Welcome, Jack. You know, there's all these kinds of things that are part of the office inertia, the way we understand the office, that, you know, are just not there. And so we put a lot of thought and deliberateness into the onboarding process. We asked ourselves, how do we make people feel special, you know, in ways that are not very unlike, you know, the cake and the team lunch, but can be as cool and as memorable. And so we have iterated our onboarding process I think as much as any software company has iterated its process in the last 4 years, it is a thing of beauty, right? Insofar as all the ways in which it anticipates the needs, both emotional and functional, of a person arriving into the organization. Now, this is something that we did out of necessity because we don't have an office. But the general example is become deliberate about the ownership of the employee experience from beginning all the way through to, let's say, peak engagement, right? And that's not something that, like, I think HR has really been tasked with or had the ability to try to construct. Because, you know, one of the things about the office is you didn't need instructions. You just show up, you know how it works. Oh, I sit here, my boss is there. You know, the meeting is over there. But without the office, everything has to be made up. And so what the takeaway there is that whether you work at the office, whether you're hybrid or whether you're fully remote, empower HR to take ownership of the employee experience. And in there, the elevation of human centricity with things like, hey, you know, let's think blank sheet of paper from a first principle standpoint, all the ways in which we could make a person feel unanxious and welcome, you know, in their first day at a 600 person company that has no offices. Like, no, that won't be overwhelming, right? And so I think you know, really it is a matter of shifting perspective and asking ourselves the questions that treat our employees as fully dimensional human beings, you know, who are not just their resumes, who are not just their demographics, who are, you know, every day living dynamic lives with events that influence how they work, et cetera. What, you know, being a caregiver, for example, knowing that about someone, knowing that someone, let's say, has disproportionate economic responsibility because they have kind of an extended family. I mean, that is what human centricity means. These are the things that need to be sort of thought about and that HR needs to be concerned with at a human-centric organization, I believe.
Yeah, Jack, I would love to hear kind of what you do, because from my perspective, I've been running a search firm for 25 years, and there's such like anger, animosity, you know, trepidation, where when it's, let's, you know, they're looking to onboard somebody, even from getting an offer, you know, they're saying, okay, Rick, we're going to give you an offer. We're going to send it out to Friday. So you're like waiting for Friday. Friday comes, Friday goes. Now it's Monday. Now it's Tuesday. Where's my offer? Then maybe they're looking for, we have to do a background check. Okay, that seems reasonable. Day goes by, week goes by, month goes by. What do I do? Am I hired? Am I not hired? It really is very dysfunctional. And this is not a generalization. I hear this from people all the time, and it's so frustrating to them because you get so excited. Hey, I got a job. This is great. I got the offer. But then you feel there's no man, woman zone. Like, well, what's happening? Do they renege? I'm not hearing from anybody. They're not communicating.
It's awful.
They're not sending an email or text or something. Say, okay, hey, there's a little bit of a glitch. Here's what we're doing. Sorry about that. Or, you know, Joe was out of the office, so he couldn't sign off of that, and Jane had to do this. But it's such from the outside perspective, what you might think should be a straightforward program bringing somebody aboard is like terrifying to some people. It's nerve-wracking.
Talent acquisition is, and you know, no disrespect to the wonderful practitioners, it is not their fault. They are working in a system, and they are working against inertia. But I think that if I were to try to simplify it as much as possible for someone, say, who's unconvinced yet, I would say, you need to think about the people that you want to hire as passionately and with as much interest as you think about your customers. How you acquire them, how you keep them, how you politely decline the ones that, you know, don't become your customers so that they don't speak ill in the world against you. That I think is a big light bulb that needs to go off at the highest level. And I think it needs to be a CEO down thing that is understood that that companies need to do this very differently than they have in the past. Let's say it comes from a commitment to wanting to distinguish your organization as a great place to work, right? This is the fame that you want to have in the world, right? And so that, I think, as a part of it, requires a ground up reinvention of how you bring people in, how you write job descriptions, right? As I said earlier, it is far harder than putting stuff up on your website or on LinkedIn and expecting the candidates of your dreams or even any candidates to find you. It's a different world, right? And so it's broken, it's dysfunctional. The answer is think about the people you want to hire the same way or even more passionately than the way you think about your customers.
So is that kind of what you're working on with Oyster, where, as you mentioned, like first principles to say, here's the job description and let's be transparent about it. Everything. See, I would love to see this. Let me give you, I don't think this will happen, but I just throw this out just for food for thought. How great would it be if you have a job description where you could actually talk about the person with whom you're going to work for? What's their idiosyncrasies? What's a little bit about them? So going in, just like they, ask you all the questions, so you know about everything. Salary transparency, and not only just the salary bonus, equity, options, what have you.
When you're thinking like this is marketing.
Yeah.
When you put the marketing hat on and you're thinking, what are the things that I need to do to find this person? You're thinking about a customer this way, but amazing changes happen when you think about the people you want to hire. Yes, suddenly a job description becomes a very different kind of document, right? When you flip the perspective that way, suddenly the interview experience becomes very different when an organization is as concerned and as interested in that optimal outcome as they are when it is a prospect in the pipeline, right?
Right, because how many times do you see, I don't know if you go on LinkedIn or other sites or Twitter X, one of the biggest things drive people crazy is that you go on an interview and go meet with 3-6 people. Let's say you're a mid to senior level, professional, 3-6 plus people, maybe have to do a project, maybe have to do whatever, and then ghosted. And then you never hear back. And then the person's like, what just happened here? I thought this was going well and nothing.
Yeah. And I'd like to think that we're on an improving trend where I think more and more the talent acquisition function will understand and acknowledge that. And the penalty of those offenses will be significant, let's say, in terms of reputation. I think so. I believe that's the trend we're on. But I am surprised to hear stories about that kind of thing. During recent tech layoffs, et cetera. I thought we had become kinder collectively than some. And maybe you just hear the worst stories, right? Like I said, I'm hopeful, but yes, I am saddened that we continue to see examples where folks who are looking for employment, who are and I remember what that was like, when you're on the other end of that email or that phone call on which everything depends, and what kind of a weekend am I going to have, right? That kind of anxiety. And so I think that the most successful companies are going to be the ones that are the most human centric, and human centricity will dictate new behaviors, around that sort of thing.
For you, that's great, Jack, because you have, since you're still, early on, relatively speaking, compared to companies that have been around forever, to look around and say, hey, I don't want to do what they did, because this is what I'm hearing from guys like Jack and others. So we're going to do the opposite. Because if you do the opposite, they're going to want to work for your company because they can say, hey, they treat me well. They treat me with respect and dignity and courtesy. If I have a choice, I'm going to go to Oyster and Jack, So I think that's a differentiator in the marketplace.
It has been.
Right?
Yeah, yes. I mean, we're certainly, I would say, an example of success there. We've presented a lot of transparency and human centricity in the employment experience that we're promising to folks that are joining the organization. And that, together with the fact that we have no geographic constraints on where we can hire, I think those things together have been incredible for us. Incredible. Yeah.
Can you give us a sneak peek? Because Unity, you know, Jack has alluded to this, 3 years, $1 billion plus unicorn valuation, 500 employees around the world. Can you give us a preview into how you hire for your team, what candidates should expect, and how they can stand out if they're going through the interview process with you all?
Sure. So we put a high value on communications. We, for example, embrace asynchronous communications as an organization, which puts a significant expectation on writing abilities. Writing is, say, more important at Oyster. I think writing is important everywhere you do knowledge work. But let's say it's differently important at Oyster because of the focus that we put on asynchronous communication. Not everybody can make a meeting, et cetera. And so we have some innovative previews as part of the candidate process that allow them to present themselves like via Loom, right? So that they can, you know, we give them like a Loom to record so that that Loom can be shared with different people throughout the organization. And people say who can't all attend a live interview can get to know the candidate. For example, we provide extensive resources around the employment experience at Oyster. Like, it's all very clear. You really sort of had a very, very clear sense of how Oyster works, even how your team works as part of the pre-joining process. So those are some of the ways I think that we do it differently.
Got it. And so I suspect, you know, as you're going through the process, as you're maybe completing the interviews or recording your Loom, it probably should be very important kind of understanding how your experience or how your interests match up with kind of the mission of being people-centric, or how you kind of demonstrate that service orientation.
Yeah. Yeah. Another great question. Because we are so mission-driven, because we place such an emphasis, such a passionate emphasis on our mission, it gives us a way to connect with people that is different, right? Let's say then companies that don't have that. And so when we feel that connection, and you know, it does happen, sometimes it doesn't happen. But when it does happen, it is a very special signal, a very of let's say likely success at Oyster in particular. That is, I think, different than it's not a signal companies, you know, lots of companies have. And by that I mean that a passionate connection to the mission can absolutely become a success factor at Oyster. Of course, you know, it doesn't. It may not redress other skills that need to be attached to this particular job, but it is a factor we have learned to weight because we've seen people go on and be very successful who have that connection at the door.
And you're a B Corp. This guy, right? B Corp. So the ethos, and you're actually tied to how, you know, being a public kind of service impact company, right?
Yes, a B Corp is, we're very proud of our B Corp.
Rick is looking at me like, hey, how did Jack know that?
There's Google, and Jack is also smart and possessed of many, many facts from diverse domains. In this time of many companies wanting to do it better, do it right, it becomes important for there to be standards and guidelines. And so we embrace B Corp as such a standard that we think it is important to create some behavioral guidance, some governance guidance for companies that are trying to have a positive impact in the world. So we embrace it as an important standard from that standpoint. But, you know, to your earlier, you know, in commentary on our unicorn status, the number of companies that are a B Corp and unicorn is very, very tiny. Less than 20. Wow. Less than 20 in the world ever. And you know, we're very proud of that. But I think the most exciting thing that signals, I think, is to all those people, let's say, let's sidebar a minute on the recent super intense political discourse that we've had on, you know, the question of ESG in the investment world. We have some folks that are very, very passionately against there being any consideration of positive impact in investment philosophies. And we know that that's coming largely from those industries that don't want to lose their access to capital because their, let's say, bad behavior or negative impact is so insurmountable. But there are people who believe that positive impact and commercial success not only can come together. So on one side, we have folks who say those things can't combine. You know, get your ESG, get your woke out of my investment philosophy. I'm focused on maximizing profits. The people that are saying that those things are like oil and water, they're can't mix. There's some other people in the investment community that are saying, hey, no, you know what? We believe that those things actually can mix. And so what I'm happiest about our B Corp plus unicorn status is to serve as an example that those things can absolutely come together like oil and water in a 1+1=3 kind of way.
Wow. I really appreciate that perspective, right? Because I think, especially with the blind community, a lot of professionals really over-index or over-optimize on trying to make the most amount of money possible or trying to like climb the career ladder as quickly and get those, rack up those promotions and job levels. But if you take a step back, one common theme that we've heard from some of these like high-powered executives like yourself that come on the show is if you start from first principles and really think about the mission or your own kind of professional development needs, the money, the careers, the promotions will actually follow. And I really appreciate Oyster putting it really front and center in the hiring and what you're doing in terms of saying, hey, we're actually here to do some common good. We're going to be darn good at it, right? Because obviously there's a skills component to our interview process, and that's how we're going to, you know, be effective for our clients and our customer base. But I think what I'm trying to say is, why do you think your approach or this approach is so rare just generally in the industry or just generally among professionals that are seeking these kind of roles?
Right. So to comment on this oil and water thing, bringing together a positive impact and commercial success in one organization, the reason that's a novel idea is simply historical inertia. Corporations evolved to optimize certain things, and you know, like I think the corporation is an amazing vehicle for progress and the deployment of capital to build cool things, if not necessarily solve the world's problems. There's opportunity for improvement of the model, right? And so, because that requires new thinking, right? Simply put, there's friction and there's resistance, and this is why it's going to be challenging. But this is why I think holding up examples more and more of companies that are showing materially their positive impact in the world, and also showing how their commitment to doing that has become a success factor. I think, you know, we're going to see more of that. We're just going to continue to see more and more of that in this values shifted post-pandemic world, where, as I said, people are choosing who they buy from and who they work for with different criteria than in the past.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? Because there clearly is that demand there from professionals who are looking for those types of roles, certainly from customers that are seeking out certified B corporations, you know, companies that are pledging to put the common good first. It really is there, right? There clearly are people that care about it, and you could do damn well good if you cater to those people.
Yes, and one negative of, let's say, all kinds of companies becoming interested in branding themselves this way is that there's going to be a lot of noise, and it's going to become difficult to actually discern the hyperbole or the straight up misinformation or deception from companies that are doing it right. So this is why we're all of these self-imposed rigors. B Corp certification is one. Our annual impact report is another self-imposed rigor, where we're sharing very transparently, very explicitly, our performance in terms of impact. And I should say that for folks that are interested in that sort of thing, and by that I mean ESG/impact and reporting, an innovation that we came up with at Oyster that I think is worth sharing is that we break down our impact into two domains. One of them is, you know, internal, and the other is external. Internal is what most companies think of as ESG, which is the effect of the organization itself, the people employed by the company, its environmental footprint, which contrasts with its diversity, its transparency, its governance, et cetera. You know, that basket of things is what we call internal impact. The other impact domain, external, is what we also call business model impact. And so the idea there is that we want, Oyster is an example of a business whose business model produces measurable positive impact in the form of people hired and paid in emerging economies. It's very easy to see that impact. For us, it's about 30%. 30% of the people on the Oyster platform are in the emerging world. And so that's a very clear indicator of, say, the overall efficiency of our business model in generating impact. That perspective, I think, is available to all kinds of businesses who have the opportunity to connect some dots between their business model and measurable positive impact. That can be social positive impact, as it is, you know, largely for us. We're focused on the problems of economic inequality, but those dots could also connect to environmental issues. We know that the world is filled with global scale problems, racial inequality, gender inequality, economic inequality, you know, et cetera. The list goes on. And so what we're hoping to do, what I'm passionately hoping to do, is to turn on more entrepreneurs to this idea of designing businesses with business models that have some intrinsic capacity to deliver positive impact. Like I said, for us, you might say it's 30%. For other businesses, it might be 5%. But if all businesses embrace this way of thinking and they define impact, you know, not in arbitrary ways, you know, like we want to send, you know, flowers, you know, to this country because it's lovely. No, if we use acknowledged references like the United Nations Sustainability Development Goals, for example, right, of which there are, you know, fewer than 20, and they're all really, really, really important. Imagine what entrepreneurship looks like if we start thinking about the companies that we create with global scale business problems in mind and design business models that are intended to attack them. So that's the macro. That's the template that I would really love to shout about, you know, from the rooftops.
No, I appreciate that insight and kind of your passion for this kind of work. It's really been enlightening. Thank you, Jack, for coming on
the show. Thank you. Thank you so much, Rick and Jack. Such a pleasure.
That's it for The Blind Ambition. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.